Hi, this is Rabia Chaudhary, and welcome to the Undisclosed Addendum. I'm excited to be hosting today, and today we're going to be talking about episode 2 of the new season of Undisclosed. It's about Jeff Titus, who was convicted of the 1990 murders of Doug Estes and Jim Bennett 12 years after the murders actually took place. Titus is currently incarcerated in Michigan and has always maintained his innocence. Now, if you haven't listened to the episode, we're going to be talking about pause right now, go back and listen, and then come back and listen to this conversation because we are still going to be here. We welcome back to the show this week, Jacinda Davis, who we had last week. Hi, Jacinda, how are you doing?
I'm fine, thanks. How are you?
I'm well. Jacinda is an Emmy Award-winning producer. She's the executive producer at Red Marble Media, where she's deeply involved in lots of aspects of production on several true crime series for Investigation Discovery, including the top-rated Evil Lives Here, Shattered, and the new long-format series Killer in Question. Jacinda started out her career in true crime working on the long-running John Walsh series America's Most Wanted. Legendary, absolutely. And we have our very own Susan Simpson, who everybody knows is a DC-based lawyer and co-host of Undisclosed, and also my co-host for the 45th. Hey, Susan.
Hey, Rabia.
All right. So let's get into it. So first of all, this week, I believe it was this past Sunday that Killer in Question aired with the Jeff Titus episode, right?
That's correct. It aired on Sunday, November 1st.
So I want to ask you, Jacinda, you know, as you're producing this and doing the interviews, was there any difference between the interviews you did for this show than what you've done in the past?
Well, the interviews for this show were a little different than what we typically do, in the sense that people have a very strong opinion about whether Jeff is innocent or guilty, and they wanted to get their point across. So it wasn't as much storytelling as some of our other interviews are. This was more, I don't quite know how to explain it. It felt more like
a cage match at times.
Really? So people were that invested?
No, it was, everyone had a very, very firm position, and they were sort of like trading blows through the episode.
It actually kind of felt, it was fun in a way. I mean, I hate to use the word fun when we're talking about crime and murder, but the interviews were, they were lively. They were energetic. It felt like, at times it felt like a debate. At times it felt very personal because this story weighs on everybody, you know, in different ways. The cold case detectives, the original detectives, Jeff's family, the victim's family. It's been 30 years and this still weighs on them heavily. So there were moments of this kind of like personal insight. But generally the interviews were very lively. It felt like a debate. It felt like this is the story I want to get across. And, you know, I just kind of navigated their perspective.
I mean, I think that's great to do because then people can see how much, like how passionate people feel about this on both sides. And it's really interesting because you don't often come across a case like that where people are actually want to talk on camera and talk. I mean, for us, for Undisclosed, often it can be pretty tough to get folks to want to talk. A lot of times they'll just say, yeah, I don't want to stay out of it. But you actually also had detectives on camera. Can you tell us about what law enforcement officers you're able to access for the show and how they were involved in the case?
Sure. Well, I think the word you use that kind of nails at home is passionate. People are very passionate about this case and their involvement in the case. So we were able to interview some of the cold case detectives. We interviewed Mike Brown. We interviewed Mike Workema, and we interviewed at the time he was the prosecutor. At the time they put the case together to arrest Jeff, Stuart Fenton is his name, but he didn't actually prosecute the case. By that time he had moved on to a different job.
Yeah, people are so passionate about this case that even the prosecutor who didn't prosecute it at trial wants to come on camera to talk about it.
So Stu Fenton, that's the person you're talking about. What was his role in the case back in the day?
He was the cold cases. He was the prosecutor at the time that they made the arrest. So, you know, the cold case team was working with him to put it together to make the arrest. He just didn't go to trial with it. So he was involved in the beginning. Mm.
And the cold case detectives, I mean, they understand that you are challenging their arrest and investigation and conviction and everything, right? And they still wanted to participate?
Absolutely. I mean, everyone knew we were telling the story from both perspectives, the perspective of the original detectives and the perspective of the cold case detectives, as well as sort of, you know, like the outliers, the friends and family of Jeff and the other, you know, the other people involved in the case. But yeah, absolutely. Everyone wanted to participate. They wanted to have their side of the story be heard.
Yeah. So you had, to me, the Killer in Question episode was sort of the story of the two pairs of detectives, really. The cold case guys, Workema and Brown, who know and have worked with for many years, but now are in firm disagreement with the original detectives, Roy Ballett and Bruce Worsema. And you can tell, like, it's personal at times. Like, this is not just an academic debate for them. Like, they know each other. They live in the same town still. And I think probably for a lot of them, hearing the other side talk about their views is probably the first time they've had that kind of, well, definitely the first time it's been publicly aired, where they fall on the side of the case.
Well, I was just wondering, is there like some other kind of rivalry outside of this case as well, you think?
I don't think so. That's we've had cases like that where that's kind of a subtext. Right. I have not so much gotten that impression here. In fact, a lot of them talk about how they are friends still with detectives who are, quote unquote, on the other side. There are other officers involved, law enforcement involved, who are not in the show, who also have firm opinions. And even though they'll still call these colleagues friends and are still friends, like, this is still between them. This is still a thing that has hung there for 20 years now.
Yeah, I agree. I think I think they all respect each other very much, and they respect each other's work. And it's one of those cases where they've agreed to disagree. But, you know, the original detectives, Roy Ballett and Bruce Worsema, they feel passionately about this. Like, for them, it's not enough just to disagree. They want something to happen. They feel like Jeff deserves another chance.
I'm just curious, do they also feel passionately about an alternate suspect? Do they have somebody that they really think should have been the one to be serving time for this?
I don't think that's really part of it.
I don't think so either. Yeah, no,
that's interesting.
It feels like, you know, they chased a lot of leads, which I'm sure the podcast will go
into. We'll get into that.
yeah, I know we will.
And I don't know that the original detectives have a strong sense that they know who it was. They just feel very strongly that it wasn't Jeff.
Right. So let me ask you, you said it aired on Sunday. Were you watching how viewers responded on social media?
I was. I sometimes monitor the Twitter feed and Facebook feed, and the audience that watches ID is very active on social media.
They are.
Are they kind of like armchair detectives?
No, it's like it was entertaining. They're very lively.
They're very lively. People were engaged. I feel like people were interested. They were making their own opinions. They were flip-flopping a little bit.
Quite a lot, I think, actually. Like, each time you'd have like a new segment, they'd be like, oh, nope, homeboy's guilty, change my mind.
That means you're doing it right. And so are they following the Discovery ID social media, or is there one specifically for Killer in Question, like a handle for Killer in Question?
There was a hashtag Killer in Question. Is that the one you were following too, Susan?
Mostly, yeah.
Yeah, there is also ID hashtag, and, you know, I think there's an ID addicts hashtag. So there's several that you can follow.
Oh, that's going to be fun to watch. How did, by the way, the viewers respond to the detectives, like cold case versus like the older detectives? Did they have an opinion, strong opinions about those guys?
They did have strong opinions about those guys, you know, and I feel like they felt like the cold case team was being defensive, which I didn't see that as much, you know, when we were putting the show together. I think sometimes passion can be misinterpreted as defensiveness.
Mm-hmm. It does seem like, though, so Workema and Brown are not defensive by default. Like, that's not like they're not like that all the time. And Steve Fitton, they're able to talk about the case in a very, you know, persuasive, normal way. But the questions that were relevant to this episode, the questions that were important for what you were discussing, yeah, they were defensive, pretty much all those questions. So they came off looking defensive all the time because they had no answers for a lot of what that was discussed in the episode here.
Right. I mean, I can't imagine not being defensive when you're being challenged by, you know, I mean, some of the things that, some of the facts around the case. I mean, I would assume that's normal or a natural reaction.
If they looked into stuff and be like, oh, hey, we know what that is. Here's like answers for it. They wouldn't be, but they didn't have the answers.
And it goes both ways. Like, you know, the cold case detectives were criticizing or critiquing the original detective's work as well. You know, they both have critiques about what each team did and how they handled the case and maybe what they should have done or what they missed. So it wasn't all pointed at the cold case detectives. You know, there were definitely some critiques about the original detective's investigation as well.
Yeah, I did like the part, though, where you had the cold case guys complaining about how the original detectives didn't look into stuff or didn't follow leads or didn't check things out. And then you have them asked about Thomas Lee Dillon. They're like, oh, never heard about that.
I was going to ask you, Susan, do you think some of the questions you guys were asking, was that like the first time they're even asked these questions or they even considered any of this? Is that why they have no answers?
They say it is.
Oh, okay. All right. Well, let's talk about Thomas Dillon. All right. Can you tell us a little bit about who he was, Susan or Jacinda, whichever one takes the lead on here?
Yeah. Thomas Lee Dillon was a serial killer in Ohio. And I've learned from working on this case that basically all serial killers are in Ohio. And also, just in front of me, Rochester, New York.
It's true. Rochester, New York, and Ohio.
Are there just like really high numbers of serial? I've never heard of serial killers from Ohio. I didn't know that.
Every major serial killer has like gone through Ohio at some point. Like, it's crazy. You're trying to look up stuff about a certain serial killer and you have like four others popping up and you're like, no, I want the other highway killer.
Not that one.
And what was the one in Rochester you're talking about, Jacinda?
Rochester too. I mean, at one point I was talking to some detectives up there who were telling me a story about they thought they had a serial killer, but they couldn't quite figure out, you know, usually there's a type or, you know, there's a victim profile and it just wasn't making sense to them.
And
yeah, you know, like the victims were so different. It wasn't clicking for them. And then they realized they actually had two serial killers operating at the same time.
Wow. So, well, so, let's talk about this one. I mean, he was a serial killer. What was his MO, Susan?
Well, that is something we'll get into a lot more later on.
Okay.
But Dillon was interesting in that he preferred his the five murders he was convicted of were all of men who were alone in the outdoors, hunting or fishing. And that's actually a pretty rare sort of serial killer. You have like the DC Sniper, of course, and ones like that. But there aren't many like Dillon who specifically hunt out hunters or fishermen. So he often shot from a distance. He'd go out and, you know, just drive around basically till he found someone who was alone and crime of opportunity, kill them and move on. He might have never gotten caught if he hadn't been like, you know, probably most serial killers wanting notoriety and wrote to the press, kind of, depending on how you interpret the letter, either bragging about his existence or, as he claims to be doing, offering comfort to one of the families of the victims. No, it wasn't, but whatever. He was active from 89 to 1992 when the FBI put together that, like, oh gosh, all these similar murders in different counties in Ohio, those are possibly the acts of one person. So they began investigation and they eventually found him. A friend tipped them off and they arrested him December 1992.
Okay, so he was active basically in the time that these murders occurred.
He was super active. As they discussed on the show, he had a murder both the week before and the week after the murders at the Fulton State Game Area. Almost all of Dillon's kills were on Saturdays. He worked a 9-to-5 job, so during the week he usually did not do murders, unless he had a day off from work.
Yeah, sometimes a day off, he might go out driving around looking for somebody. But you're right, it was always, it seemed more likely to be on a weekend, on a day off.
Yeah. So this weekend, at least the 17th and 18th, he has no known kills, but he very much was out and about, driving around, looking for victims during this time period.
What about proximity? How close or far was he from the crime scene?
So he had about four and a half hours, depending on, well, on the day of the question. His home was about 4.5 hours, but he was a bit closer on the day of, because he was hunting somewhere else. But what we do know is that Dylan just liked to drive hundreds of miles. He would get in his car and just start driving randomly all over the backwoods of Ohio.
We also know there's a moment in the show where Bruce Buscema, one of the original detectives, is reading a letter that Dylan sent to a newspaper. And in this letter, he actually says, you know, I've had other opportunities to kill in other states, but I just haven't done it. And hopefully I won't.
But we know it's a lie because he took an opportunity. He had killed someone between that murder and the letter. So he's not telling the truth about his not having killed more in that time period.
The five that he confessed to, were they all in Ohio or were they in other states too? Do you know?
The five are all in Ohio.
Okay. The ones he confessed to, yeah. But the letter I find interesting because he admits that he's been in other states. I've had opportunities to kill in other states. So the idea that he only drove around Ohio just doesn't make sense.
And we know he traveled a lot. Like in 1990 alone, he was like, what, in Ontario, D.C., Pennsylvania?
Wow. Well, was he ever considered a suspect? Did anybody ever look into him or connect this to other hunters who have been killed, murderers?
You know, they did. I mean, I was going to say they did consider other possible crimes he could be linked to, but consider could be too strong a word, which we'll discuss more in the show too. But I definitely believe that there are crimes that he committed that he was never, definitely not charged with and did not plead guilty to. And that possibly never really got examined for reasons I'm still not sure about.
Yeah, I mean, it seems that you said he killed one person the week before these murders and the one person or somebody afterward. I mean, that's a pretty high rate of, you know, I can't imagine if he killed only five people in that entire time span that he was active.
His first attempted kill that he confessed to was 1980. He was not charged with that one, and the person was not killed. They survived somehow. And supposedly, he did not strike again until 1989. And then he, over 3 years, committed five murders, and that was it.
Okay, so when you said that he was kind of considered, what do you mean by that? Like, what happened with that?
Well, they looked for cases that could possibly fit this MO. They found a few in different states. The Michigan case was one of them. And that's when, as they talked about on Killer in Question, they had the witnesses who saw Ditch Guy, as we've called him, the guy in the ditch, yes, Ditch Guy, came to Ohio and did a lineup. Like, they saw a lineup of six men, one of whom was Thomas Lee Dillon. And yeah, well, I don't even know how to describe the next part because I still can't really comprehend that sequence of events.
Are you going to be getting into it later in the season?
Well, basically, long story short, there was an ID made. Both witnesses ID'd Dillon. But for whatever reason, Michigan doesn't seem to have figured that out.
Well, what happened when so the cold case detectives, like, you presented them with this Dylan stuff, and like, how do they react?
They, you know, the cold case detectives, when we asked them about Dylan and presented the Dylan information, they said they were not aware of that angle. They weren't aware of that lead. So it wasn't something they looked at during their reinvestigation.
But wouldn't it have been in their files? I mean,
yeah,
no?
You'd think so, right?
Okay.
You know, it seems like back in 1990, the lead didn't come through until 92. Is that right, Susan? That's when
late 92.
You know, late 92 is when the witnesses were taken to Ohio to do.
Sorry, 93. They came in February 93, but they were first contacted, the Michigan authorities were, in late 92.
And they went down there, they did the lineup, the witnesses picked out Dylan, and then it seems like it just fizzled from there. And it could be because they thought he had an alibi. It just went cold at that point. And I don't know why the cold case team didn't know about it or why they didn't, if they did know about it, why they didn't pursue it further.
Well, if this happened in 92, then I'm assuming the original detectives must have known about it.
They did. One of them was there. Well, one of them's dead now, but one of the, Warsima was actually there in Ohio with the witnesses.
Okay. And that's kind of odd, because if those are the detectives who already think that, you know, they didn't have any leads, this would seem like a really strong lead. And
yeah, it's weird, right?
It's weird. I'm sure you have theories, Susan.
I got you.
Maybe we have to wait for them. All right. And so where is Dylan now? Is he was arrested in 92, you said?
Yeah, 92, convicted the next year. He died in 2011, which is unfortunate, I guess. But at the same time, like, I thought about this a lot. I'm like, you know, I mean, I wish we'd looked at this case 10 years ago. We could talk to Dylan. But part of me thinks that's maybe it's for the best that we can't, because how could you believe a word he said anyway?
Mm. Yeah, I think it's really interesting because, you know, people are always like, well, if he was alive, we could ask him, but how do we trust he's telling you the truth, right?
Right.
He,
right. I mean, unless he was able to offer information that he shouldn't know, right?
But then you wonder, after this many years, like, at that point, he's had lots of potential sources to, like, learn stuff about the case. I mean, it's, yeah. I mean, he's in prison. He's got time on his hands. We know he followed murders while in prison because he, well, we'll get into that more too. But I definitely would have seen it within his ability to have gathered info on various crimes that he was interested in during that time period.
Mm. All right. So we'll wait till you get to that point in the season, and then I'll drill down, because I feel like there's got to be something that, like, wasn't made public, or only somebody who had access to the files of it. But anyway. All right. So,
But also, I think it's interesting too, to, like, see how the cold case guys responded to, at the end of the show, how they responded to the new stuff. And Mike Brown, I've talked to him as well, the detective from the cold case team, like, he is willing to concede, essentially, that Dylan could have been there, like, driving by the game area, and it's just a coincidence. Titus still did it, and the serial killer just happened to be there.
That's kind of a stretch. So he's actually, okay, that's kind of a stretch. Wow. I mean, so that means he's really committed to Jeff's guilt. I mean, like, that. Those are some blinders, it seems like, to me. But, all right, so it seems like there's been some confusion about what case we are actually covering. I remember when... I think we did a trailer, and a lot of folks were like, oh, this is about, because people were like, oh, it's a case of two hunters murdered in Michigan. They think it's a case about another case by the Duvall brothers, right?
Yeah, we've definitely gotten a lot of people who have seen the trailer or, like, read a summary of the case and have written to us and been like, why are you covering that case? because they hear, yeah, two hunters murdered in Michigan. And what they think of is the much more high profile case of the Duvall brothers. Who were convicted of killing two hunters in Michigan. And they were convicted in 2003, but the murders happened in 1985. And if you've heard about this case, it's probably because it's the one where supposedly the Duvall brothers killed the victims and fed them to their pigs. Yeah. Jacinda, have you heard about this case?
You know, I don't know about this case, actually.
Yeah, I can see why people were wondering why we're going to cover it. but just so to be totally clear, this is not that. It's not the pig case. It's a very different deer hunter case. But yeah, so in 85, there were two hunters in their early 50s, David Till and Brian Ogjan, who went out on a hunting trip and were going to, like, see some friends, go to a cabin, and just never arrived. They seemed to have disappeared at a town called Mio, in north central Michigan, I guess. And they just find nothing. Their car is gone. Their personal effects are gone. They never find any bodies, still never found any bodies. And it's just a complete cold case until a few years later, some people come forward and say, yeah, there's this family in town, the Duvalls, and they've been bragging about killing those two hunters. Because other witnesses back in 85 had said, we thought we saw them here in town at the bar for a couple days. We saw their black SUV. Anyway, either because the two friends, Till and Ogjan, started a fight at a bar or something, or maybe hit on a woman, or possibly there was a fight in the woods over a deer that was killed. It's not totally clear. They were killed by the Duvall brothers, according to a witness, and the Duvall brothers then disposed of the bodies by feeding them to their pigs, allegedly, and the car was disassembled by a third brother who had, like, a scrapping business. And it is kind of an interesting case because, like, the evidence is very, it's a cold case that was prosecuted many years later, and the evidence is kind of not always as solid as you'd expect. I mean, it's a no-body case, so it's going to be hard for that alone. But there are conflicting stories about what exactly Duvall Brothers did with the bodies or how they got rid of them. Maybe I just hope it's not true, but I'm not convinced by the pig theory.
oh, really?
I mean, maybe, but like not all witnesses heard confessions allegedly to that story.
But when you say the third brother helped dispose of bodies and the fourth brother helped get rid of the car, is that because they confessed to doing those things, or people, they were witnesses? I mean, how do we know?
Yes, they said they had, but then they kind of, okay. One of them recanted. So it's very fuzzy memories later on. But it does seem like there was some kind of altercation at a bar.
So all four of them went to prison?
Nope, just two.
Oh, what?
Just the two brothers who were actually involved in the actual murders, allegedly.
Well, okay. It does not sound like the kind of family you want to get in altercation with.
Yeah, that was the story at trials. Like, all the witnesses who came forward later, they basically all said, well, we are not eager to come forward about the Duvall brothers. earlier.
They had a reputation.
Yeah, for obvious reasons.
Yeah. All right, so it's not that case. This is Jeff Titus, folks.
Not that case. It is a very different case from 1990 that was also a cold case and solved about the same time, but not that one.
So let's talk about this week's episode. The detectives looked at possible connections between Doug Estes and Jim Bennett. And that was something that was kind of like nobody could figure out. Nobody who knew Doug, nobody who knew Jim could figure out why they would be together. They didn't seem to like have any overlap, like, you know, in their social lives in any way. So I'm wondering, like, at the beginning of the investigation, did they have any leads about like any particular reason they thought they could have been connected?
I think from the start, it was just because the bodies were so close together. There had to have been some kind of interaction between them before they died. They were close together. And since the two shots came within seconds of one another, they weren't far apart. Whatever happened. So naturally, yeah, you're going to look into whether or not these two victims had known one another. Were they talking? Were they meeting?
I think that's exactly right. The proximity of the bodies suggests that they had to have seen each other, and they had to have probably said hi to each other at least.
About how far apart were the bodies?
About 25 feet, maybe.
Oh, wow. Okay.
Ballpark. Yeah. It's also, we'll get more into this later too, but like it's not a very big patch of woods. It's the trees aren't that thick. It's not that wide.
And the fall, so there's not a lot of foliage. Yeah.
And to have three people gathered there at one time, as must have what happened. It does seem strange. It would have been a very crowded area there when this crime happened.
I think they also thought maybe there was some kind of connection, because when they looked into their histories, both the victims dealt in drugs. So the question was, did they know each other through that?
Yeah.
They both sold drugs.
Yes. They both had like histories, you know, in the drug trade in certain various different ways. So they thought that maybe, you know, was it a drug deal? Was it like something along that line? And there were actually surprising number of like, you know, not direct connections between the victims, but like secondhand or thirdhand connections. Because the two victims were from areas that were fairly far apart. It's about a half hour, 35 minute drive between Comstock, where Doug Estes was from, and Leonidas, where Jim Bennett was from. Like these are kind of different worlds. I mean, it's not forever away. People do go back and forth, but like these are not the same towns, not the same worlds. So what's kind of surprising that there were actually quite a few overlaps between their circles of friends. Although all of those, you know, friends in common or connections in common, all said that they never saw Bennett and Estes. Well, I should clarify. Almost all of those connections said that they never saw Bennett and Estes together.
You know, I mean, my middle school and high school, I grew up in a small Western Maryland town, and we didn't have any other high schools to even play against in sports teams. And so we would play against schools that were like 30, 40 minutes away just so we could have some kind of seasons and games and stuff. And I'm wondering if it's that kind of situation, they could have known each other, you know, just, or had heard of each other. I mean, I don't think it's that unlikely that two small towns that are 30 minutes away, people wouldn't have like some interaction. I mean, because you have nobody to hang out with.
Huh. I wonder if like Comstock ever played like what? Minden, I guess, would be the high school down there.
And it sounds like we grew up in similar areas because I also went to school in Maryland and we'd have to drive 40 minutes, an hour to go to find another high school to play a field hockey game against. But that is interesting. It feels weird to me that their paths never crossed or that they didn't know about each other. You know, like if you have, it seems like they both had reputations that at a minimum, they would have heard of each other before, which then in my mind, you know, makes me wonder, could someone have organized a rendezvous? Could someone have set them up? Hey, you should meet each other, that kind of thing. But just doesn't seem like there's any evidence to suggest that.
But the thing is that everybody's surprised that Jim Bennett was even out there because he wasn't supposed to be there. He didn't hunt there. So actually, I would think maybe he went there for a purpose. It could have been a meeting, right?
That definitely was something they looked at. Like there's enough there that seems almost promising or strange that you'd have to look into it. And even though they came up empty, they did put a lot of time into it just because there was so much there that was just suggestive that like, okay, there could be another piece here. Okay, they have Doug's cousins are running around Leonidas. Maybe they're connected somehow. It's these sort of like tantalizing clues that never, well, at least for the original investigation, never went anywhere.
I guess
it never panned out.
The two possibilities are either that it was completely random and one of them happened to come across the other who was like the actual target of the killing and then got wrapped up in it, or there was an actual meeting. I'm wondering, after all the investigation both of you have done, where have you two landed? I'm curious about your theories.
You know, one of the things I think talking to the original detectives and the cold case detectives, one of the things they both seem to agree on is that if either one of them was a target, it seems like in the middle of the woods where everybody is armed on the first Saturday of deer season is not the greatest place to go to kill somebody.
Or is it the greatest way to go? Because then no one's going to realize, if you can only kill one of them, obviously, they'll think it's an accident.
Well, and no one, you hear a shot and you think someone shot a deer. You don't think, oh, someone's being murdered. But the flip side of that is everybody is armed. And that little patch of woods is pretty small, like we were talking about. And it would be hard to get in and out unnoticed. But I don't know. I still wonder if one of them was meeting someone there. Not necessarily each other, but if someone, I don't know. Susan, what do you think?
I've come down to the side that the two of them were not going to meet there that day. That was not part of the plan. I do wonder if they had enough, if they would have recognized one another. Could they have been, you know, just together to say, hi, oh, hey, I saw you at so-and-so's party that one time. I wonder if like maybe that was the connection, but I do not think that it had anything to do with why they were there. I leave open the idea that when they did see each other in the woods, they started talking because they had whatever acquaintances in common, but yeah, the purpose to go was not to see one another.
Well, I mean, just know you just said it might have been hard for somebody to get in and out unnoticed. Does that suggest it could have been somebody else in the hunting party, in Doug's hunting party?
Yeah,
I mean, everyone's a suspect, but I meant more that like that patch of woods is so small that you would have seen the other. You would think you would have seen the other hunters coming in and out that day. The parking lot is small. Only a few cars fit in there. Like, it just doesn't seem like the place you would go, you would set up someone to get murdered. But again, in some ways, it is the perfect place. It's just really confusing and frustrating that those answers aren't easy to find.
Like Detective Worsema said, it feels like it could be anything.
Well, it seems like at least for Thomas Dillon, that serial killer in Ohio, it was kind of the perfect setup because that's where he went.
It's kind of perfect concept right there. I mean, he got away with it for years. And if he hadn't been bragging about it, probably would have not gotten caught.
So I want to talk a little bit about Bobby, who we heard from in this episode. Bobby was Doug's son or stepson?
Stepson.
Stepson, okay. How old was he at the time?
He was 18. He had, you know, Doug had been a stepdad since he was like, what, 14, I think, or 15?
15.
And the two of them had, you know, apparently bit of conflict, but like also what stepdad and his new stepson, teenage stepson, don't have conflict. Like
don't, right.
That doesn't seem at all a point even like worth making like a motive for homicide. I mean, yeah, they should look at it, but the fact that they're having conflicts between them doesn't to me mean that Bobby should have gotten the kind of scrutiny that some people thought he should have at the time. And also, as Bobby mentioned on the show, like at the time this all happened, they were hanging out together voluntarily. Like they wanted to go hunting together. They were enjoying one another's company, mostly because Bobby had moved out and they were no longer living together. And that made things much better between them.
Yeah, that changes the dynamic. So did they often go out hunting together, or this was kind of a special event?
It was a special event. I think this was the first time they'd actually gone hunt, certainly this year.
Yeah, it seemed like it was a special occasion that they, you know, Bobby made it sound like he hadn't gone hunting with Doug a lot. He was surprised that Doug was so noisy and walked around so much. And he made a comment about, I thought Doug knew how to hunt better than that.
Oh, that's interesting.
Yeah.
I mean, how did this event affect him then? I mean,
it was. I think it puts him in shock. He's traumatized by it. Not only finding the bodies, but also then becoming, you know, being looked at as a possible suspect. I don't know that he's ever quite recovered from it.
Yeah, I think that's, it was clearly a very traumatizing, very affecting event in his life. And from talking to him, I don't really get the sense that he's ever quite processed it. It definitely left a mark on him.
Does he have any, I mean, how does he feel about Jeff Titus?
You know, he's conflicted, I think. Well, not conflicted, that's the wrong word. He's confused, probably a better way to put it.
I think he's confused. I think, I'm not sure conflicted is a bad word. I think, you know, he wants to believe that the right man is in prison because I think he also is very sympathetic to anyone who is convicted of a crime they didn't commit. Like he wouldn't wish anyone to spend a day in prison who wasn't guilty. So, you know, it's that sort of, he hopes it's the right guy because he wants that closure and he doesn't want the wrong person behind bars. But I think he's confused and he's open to maybe Jeff's not the right person.
Yeah, there are parts of the case that seem very compelling to him. But at the same time, there's stuff that obviously gives him concern. Like, he has questions about some of it. So, like, some of it he's like, okay, here's why Titus has to be guilty. Look at X, Y, Z. But then he'll acknowledge, but also this happens. So I don't really quite get how that could fit in. Or I think he wants Titus to be guilty, but he kind of is afraid he's not at times.
I mean, it's a hard place. I think it's a hard place for a victim's family to be in. I mean, they want closure. They've been told by the state, they've been convinced, a jury convicted this person, and they're done. And now to kind of reopen all that, that's got to be tough. But I commend him that he's open. Even the confusion means that there is something is not sitting quite right with him, and I think that's a good place to start. I want to talk about Jim Bennett now. So I was a little bit confused about all the bombs. What is the deal? Why the bombs?
They're fun, I think. I think it just comes down to that. Like, he was a very inventive guy. He's very handy, able to make things for himself. He wasn't quite, I wouldn't say he, like, lived off the land or anything, but he was definitely self-sufficient and concerned about, yeah.
Everyone, hands down, describes him as incredibly smart. And like Susan said, inventive. And he was a tinker, and he would build bombs, and he would rig up his own electricity, and he would, I don't know, it sounds like he was always up to something. You know, people we interviewed or talked to said, this is all before internet, before YouTube. Right. You know, imagine what he could be doing now if he had the web at his fingertips.
But yeah, I think the bombs were just like his, his fun hobby. So they'd all go out to like the NPR outside of town and go set off the bombs or the bag bombs that would float over the city. And yeah, by all accounts, like, these were actually some pretty powerful things. Maybe in 1990 that was okay, but I'm 99% certain that wouldn't go over so well in modern times.
I know. I keep thinking, was he like, did law enforcement never show up?
They never did, apparently.
They seemed just to leave him alone. It was sort of like he wasn't bothering anyone.
He's harmless.
he's harmless and, you know, like...
Well, not totally. I mean, remember Skeeter told us that someone actually got badly hurt by one of the homemade gunpowder.
Really? And then, but no charges were pressed against him for that?
I'm sure they didn't press charge. Like, the people who were injured probably didn't. They probably thought... I mean, that's just what happens when you play with TNT.
Yeah. Well, speaking of Skeeter, I want to talk about that cassette tape that I guess Jim, he told... Who did he tell that
if something happens
to me? Right, his girlfriend. That's kind of, I mean, that seems to suggest he's got enemies, right? Like he, or what do you think he was pointing at? Do you think he was talking about Skeeter when he meant, in that tape or what?
God, it's a confusing issue. We'll definitely have to get more into that because it's just, I mean, how often do you have a case where like one of the victims had like a cassette or a letter and they said, oh, if something happens to me, read this and find out who killed me or whatever. And,
right.
And then it just kind of fizzles and never like, oh, whatever, just a thing. Let's not worry too much about it.
And it stands out because it doesn't seem like Jim had a lot of enemies.
No.
It seems like people liked him. They, you know, he's described kind of as a loner as well, though, but he doesn't seem like he had enemies. It seems like people liked him.
He had conflicts with coworkers, apparently. Then people, some in town didn't like him, probably because of the bomb setting off thing. But he didn't really have enemies, no.
So for him to go to the trouble of making a tape and telling his girlfriend about it seems important.
It seems really important. It seems really important that he thinks his life could be threatened. Like there's somebody out there who might want to hurt him. I mean, that seems like really, really relevant. And the tape just disappeared?
It just disappeared.
And Jim's girlfriend says she didn't listen to it. And I know.
There's no chance. Do you believe that? I don't believe it.
if my husband was to give me a tape that says, you know, listen to this if I get killed, the minute he leaves the house to go run an errand, I'm listening to that tape.
Yeah. Mine'd be lucky if I let him leave first. Like, I'd be like, okay, I'm just going to play it right now because I need to know.
But the other thing is, if my husband were to hand me something like that, I'd be like, even if I didn't listen to it, I'd be like, what's going on? Who are you scared of? Who is trying to hurt you? Like, I wouldn't just be like, oh, okay, and put it aside.
Put it with the gun under the bed and forget about it.
Yeah, you think there'd be a conversation after that. Was she ever able to, like, did she have any theories about what could have been on the tape or who Jim was afraid of or anything?
Her statement back to one of the investigators was that she thought the tape was about someone named Terry, but wasn't totally sure which Terry this was about. And there are a few Terrys in his life, so it doesn't narrow it down all that much. And she wasn't even certain about that. So yeah, that's as far as we know. That's about all we know. It's not that they didn't try and look into it. They did a little bit, but it just kind of fizzled out.
Well, I mean, I mean, unless Jim was the kind of person who maybe is a little paranoid and, you know, just is, you know, you kind of
but
dismiss.
No one says that. Yeah. Like that's also, it does seem out of character for him. It's not something that was like, okay, you weirdo. Like, that's something you do.
He did grow a lot of weed.
Oh, he did.
Maybe he made a batch that, you know, made him super paranoid.
I think, you know, that's a good point, though. Like, with that amount of weed that he had, actually at his property, and two, all the fields he was at, I mean, he probably should have been a bit paranoid, just as business sense.
So let's get to a question this week from somebody, one of our listeners. Their handle is at Gimbal Rocket. And Gimbal Rocket asked, do we know who called Jim Bennett that afternoon?
No, not for sure. To me, this is probably the number one issue that I look at the case file and I'm like, wait, why didn't y'all follow up on that? Because other stuff like the cassette tape, they did try and didn't get anywhere. But to me, it feels like they were this was never looked at in the way that you'd expect it to have been.
You know, Mandy, so Jim's girlfriend's daughter, is the one who answered the call and handed the phone to Jim. But she wasn't sure who it was on the phone.
No, the report says Skeeter.
She identified Skeeter. Skeeter was on the call.
It's such a mess because some of the reports are like written years later and it's all conflicted. At one point, she said it was Skeeter.
Has anybody spoken to her since to say, did you say Skeeter?
She doesn't recall.
She doesn't remember.
Okay.
And another detective told us, which isn't in the record, but told us his memory was that she remembered the man on the phone identified himself as Skeeter, but it didn't sound like Skeeter to her because she would have recognized his voice.
And he seemed pretty confident about that too. Like his memory is that, no, she answered the phone. Someone said it was Skeeter, but it wasn't Skeeter.
That's even weirder. Okay.
But whoever, like the point is like this call, what we know is that Jim was not going to go hunt at the Fulton State Game area. He'd never hunted there. Didn't want to go there. 2 days before, he'd been talking to a friend and been like, don't go to the Fulton State Game area. There are crazies there. Don't do it. So it's not
what
a place.
What did he mean by crazies? Like, what did he mean?
Just the crazy city hunters that were all flocking there.
Oh, okay. Okay.
And it's busy. It's opening weekend. It's busy. There's not a lot of space back there, even though acreage-wise there is. And he had other places to go. He had friends with private property, you know, his own family's property. He didn't need to go there.
By all accounts, this phone call changes Jim Bennett's mind. He has other plans that afternoon. He gets the phone call. All he says to, you know, Kimber and his girlfriend when she gets home is like, you know, I'm going out. I'll be back by 6:30. In a way, it kind of reminds me of the pager message that Hay got the day she was killed.
Yeah, I was thinking the same thing. Yeah.
Yeah, like she got that and she says, change of plans, going somewhere else now. That's what Bennett did. He was going to go hunt somewhere else on private property. This phone call comes in while he's home for lunch and his plans change. And it was never really tracked down or even really attempted to have it tracked down. Who made the call and what they said?
And it's also late, you know, he gets the call, but he doesn't, you know, depending on what time we think it was based on the VCR clock, it's sort of a last minute. He doesn't have that much time to hunt.
It's very late for hunting to go out and get in place before the deer start moving.
That's actually that's what I was going to ask you. I mean, it just seems like he already didn't think that's a good place to hunt. So I'm assuming when he got that call, he wasn't going to go there to hunt. Like, there's some other reason he was going to go there.
You know, that's still an open question because he brought his muzzleloader. He hunted only with that. And he had been planning before to go hunting that afternoon. But he's going so late in the day, so close to dusk. And according to his girlfriend, he doesn't even bring his full hunting kit. He just brought, like, some of the smaller bits and bobs, but not, like, the full kit he usually hunted with. So, yeah, there's a question there. Was he actually going hunting? Is that why he was going out there?
And we were also told that he had dinner plans that evening with his girlfriend and
at 6:30.
Her daughter. So
that wouldn't be enough time to go hunting and then go to dinner. I mean,
it would be rushed. He could have gone and had an hour or so of daylight to hunt, but it just seems a little rushed.
And for me, what seems the most significant is that we know someone called him. There's a lot of conflicting evidence about who it might have been, but someone called him and talked to him. And that person never came forward.
Yeah. And I'm assuming, like, at Nan's case, nobody ever got those call records to see if there was an incoming call that could be a number that could be checked.
We'll discuss that more later. But, like,
okay.
Whoever it was did not come forward. And that raises the question, why? Why didn't they not acknowledge that it did?
So Bennett, we know, was asked by somebody to go to Fulton. Like, he was asked to go there.
Well,
but
we don't
what about
know. All we know is that he didn't have plans to go there and got the call. Yeah.
Right. Like, it didn't seem like he had any plans to go there until he got this call. But what about the Estes party? Were they there by chance, or was that also planned for them to be there?
They also seemed to be there by chance. Bobby and his stepdad, Doug, had gone hunting in the morning. And then around lunchtime, they came back and they were meeting up with their friend, Mark Perry. And according to Bobby, they all got in the car without knowing where they were going. They hadn't decided yet. So it doesn't seem like they had plans to go there. And it doesn't seem like anyone would have known they were going there because they didn't know.
And there is conflicting evidence there too later on. But I think in general, it's safe to assume that this was sort of a spontaneous. They may have talked about going there in the abstract before, but like the day of, it does not seem like they actually were definitively going to the Fulton State Game area when they left the house. And it maybe even only ended up there because Bobby, as they're driving around, Bobby recognizes the place they've been the year before with his dad. So he's like, hey, let's go there.
That makes me wonder if Doug just didn't stumble across something and was like, hey, what's going on here? And then got hurt. But, well, I think that's it for the questions for this week. I do want to ask you, Jacinda, because now I'm intrigued. Where did you grow up in Maryland? What city, what town was this?
I grew up in Laurel, Maryland, but I went to school out in Howard County.
Okay.
So it even took me like 45 minutes to get to school.
Yeah, well, I guess Laurel's gotten much more built up since then, but yeah, it's not too far from here. Well, you weren't anywhere in my orbit, so anything else you guys want to add? Any comments you want to add about this week's episode?
Yeah, well, we'll have episode 3 on Monday, but also this coming Sunday, also 9 o'clock, there's going to be episode 2 of Killer in Question.
Oh, yeah. And Jacinda, by the way, for anybody who's missed the first episode, do you know if there's a way they can watch it?
Yes, you can download the ID Go app for free and watch it there. It will be repeating on ID as well.
The next episode of Killer in Question will air Sunday on ID at 9 p.m. Eastern. It's the case of James Duckett, who is a former cop who was convicted of murdering a 11-year-old girl in Mascot, Florida. And like the Titus case, you've got different detectives who don't agree on the outcome, and you have evidence that isn't quite as straightforward as you might think. So check it out, 9 p.m. Eastern on ID.
Or if you have Hulu TV, as I learned.
Oh, is that right? Okay. Mm-hmm. I was traveling though the weekend. I have Hulu TV. That's what I'm doing today. All right. Well, thank you guys for listening. And thank you, Jacinda and Susan, for entertaining all my questions. And if you guys have questions for next week's addendum, just email them to undisclosedpodcast@gmail.com. Of course, you can also tweet them at us on social media. You can post on Facebook. You know where to find us, Twitter, Instagram, all that. Tag it with hashtag UDAddendum. And we want to thank Hannah McCarthy for our audio production every single week. Thank you, guys, and we'll be back in a few days.